Today on Vox Talks, should there be a debt standstill for emerging and developing countries? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. If we focus on the eye-watering amounts that high-income countries are borrowing so they can get through this economic crisis, we lose sight of the sudden collapse in capital flows to emerging and developing countries at a time when their need has never been greater or more universal. Already, we know that about 100 countries have approached the International Monetary Fund for financial assistance as a result of COVID-19. A team of academics, both economists and lawyers, have proposed that we tackle this problem with a debt standstill for any developing or emerging country that wants it, and also an $800 billion credit facility that these countries can draw on to fight the pandemic. But, most controversially, it's the standstill that would finance the credit facility. Well, today I'm joined by two of the authors of this proposal that we've just published as Policy Insight, titled Born Out of Necessity. Mitu Galati from Duke University and Ugo Panizza of the Graduate Institute Geneva are going to explain how this would work and how it could be implemented in practice. So hello, Ugo.
Hi, Tim.
And hello, Mitu.
Hi, Tim.
Ugo, you start us off. How big have these capital outflows been from developing and emerging market economies in the last couple of months?
Huge. According to estimates of the Institute of International Finance, over the past 45 days, about $100 billion flew out of emerging market countries. Just to give you a comparison, after the global financial crisis, when we thought we had a huge flyout of capital, about $20 billion flew over a 3-month period. So five times as much in a shorter period of time now.
And we know that these countries are indebted. How much do they already owe, and who do they owe this to?
So the total external debt of emerging market countries is about $5.8 trillion.
Whoa.
Not all of this debt is owed by the governments of this country. Some of this debt is owed by the private sector. Governments of this country own about half of this $5.8 trillion, $2.7 trillion. And the people who lent to the government of this country are both the official sector, that is like multilateral development banks, like the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and so on and so forth, and the private sector, mostly through bonds. So out of this $2.7 trillion of debt owed by developing countries, about $1 trillion is owed to official lenders, so the World Bank and different bilateral government, and about $1.7 trillion is owed to private creditors, of which more than $1 trillion is bonds.
We are proposing a debt standstill on this. If there wasn't a crisis, roughly how much would these countries be paying back in interest and principal this year?
In total, again, if we include public and private borrowers, about $1.6 trillion. The public sector would owe, according to our estimates, these are ballpark estimate, about $870 billion.
These are huge numbers, yes. Aren't they? I thought the G20 had made some progress on this. They'd already granted some debt relief last week.
Yes, they did, but very little. So I just gave you numbers in the order of $800 billion. The debt relief granted by the G20 only focused on bilateral debt, that is debt which countries owe to other countries, so not debt owed to the private sector, of only a country which are relatively small and poor, so it doesn't amount to a lot of money. So this amount to about $14 billion. So $14 billion was granted out of a problem which is potentially $800 billion.
So it's a drop in the ocean. It seems enormous, but all numbers here are totally huge. So yeah, it is a drop in the ocean here, isn't it? So Mitu, let's get to this plan. You are envisaging a credit facility that developing and emerging countries could use. Who's going to have this? Where will this fund be?
So as we envision it, the fund will be operated, managed by one of the multilaterals. So we don't really have any particular preference as to which of the multilaterals. It could be the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, one of the other regional banks. But what is key when investors allow for a standstill? So basically, the investor is saying, I'll take my money later. To persuade an investor to take its money later, you have to give them some assurance that their money is not being taken by the leaders of that country to buy a Learjet instead of healthcare costs and resuscitating the economy. So for that reason, it's important to have some kind of mechanism that assures creditors that their money will be used for the purposes for which they are granting relief. And so for that, multilateral banks have a lot of experience in managing and monitoring funds. So any one of those institutions that are credible and trusted by this global system would suffice for this. We don't have any specific preference as to which one.
What can they use it for? What is a legitimate use of this money in your mind?
None of us on this team of economists and lawyers purport to be public health experts and claim to have any ability to specify what individual countries should use it for. We imagine that different countries, because the spread of this disease will be different and the capacities of those countries in terms of their populations will be very different, will need to use the money for different purposes. So a sparsely populated country is going to be very different than a densely populated country. Bangladesh is going to have very, very different problems than Iceland, for example.
But the principle is on this that they cannot just take this out for anything that they decide that they need it for.
Bingo. That's exactly right. And that's where the multilateral institution comes in, that they can specify you can use it for these purposes and they can monitor. So it's not just the specification, but they can provide assurances that that really is what it's being used for. And this is key because in the international system, our experience is that a lot of money gets wasted. But over the years, we have developed some credible systems by which we can assure that at least most of the money is used for the right purposes. We think that's key. If we have to design a system that actually works and doesn't blow up in our faces in 6 months.
Now, the debt standstill finances this. Is this the interest payments or is it the repayments of the loans as well that goes into this credit facility?
Primarily, we have set it up so that it focuses on interest payments. This is intentional. If you look at the data that Ugo has already talked about, there's only a few countries who have big principal amounts coming due in the rest of 2020. So for most countries, the relief will come from the interest. This doesn't mean to say that countries should be paying back the principal amounts, but we consciously want this to be a limited facility so that it is credible and provides them with relief for a narrow set of health-related emergency expenses. So you might ask, well, what if a country has a big principal amount? What does it do? So for that, we have kept in place the option to set up an alternate facility side by side for principal amounts, but we imagine that that would be negotiated on a country by country, creditor group by creditor group basis. It is crucial that this facility be relatively small so that it is credible that the investors who put their money in it will actually get it back.
Why do we have to get multilateral institutions involved in this? Why don't we just leave it to the individual countries to make their own deals with each of their creditors? They've been doing this for a long time. They know their situation. Why don't they do it?
There are a couple of reasons for this. The first reason is our experience with countries in crisis, when countries need to restructure their debt because some major event has occurred or because they've just mismanaged their economy. Investors want some kind of third-party assurance that the country is on the right path and that the money that they give them in relief is not going to be wasted. And so we are trying to set that up for the investors to provide them with that assurance. And the second reason is this is truly unusual situation that we haven't ever dealt with in most of our lifetimes, actually any of our lifetimes. Relief is needed immediately, 3 weeks ago, not prospectively after 6 to 8 months of negotiation. By then, too many people will have died. So we need to set up a facility that can work today.
Now, imagine I'm the president of one of these countries. I think it's voluntary that I take advantage of this debt standstill in your idea, isn't it? But I do. I want to take advantage of this. Who do I call?
First, we have to have some multilateral institution be willing to do this. Now, part of the willingness of the multilateral institution is going to be the willingness on the other side of countries to take advantage of it. But hypothetically, if you had a country that said, we need something like this, and they called up the World Bank has people who run these kinds of multilateral programs that every country knows and has dealt with. And they said, we would like to participate in a CCF type program. It would not be hard for it to be set up. I mean, the World Bank in particular has great expertise in setting these up, and the same with an institution like the Asian Development Bank. So in Mexico in 1982, a program like this was set up. And at that point, we didn't have the kind of expertise that we have today in dealing with this. So we've done it before. We've done it very fast. And it can be done again if there is willingness on the part of the countries to actually take this relief.
But what do I say as the president to the people that I owe the money to my creditors? What do I tell them? I'm not giving you the money for a year?
Well, I am giving it to you. I'm giving it to you, and you are agreeing to give it back to me to help me get out of this crisis. And that is crucial because investors will have an interest in the facility. And it is potential that that interest, it's like a claim, is just as valuable as the market value of their existing debt. So this facility will work if it increases the size of the pie. It will work beautifully. And investors should actually be happy, except for the small subset of investors who make money by litigating against countries in distress. And I don't think any of us are that sympathetic to their not being able to eat well during these periods of time.
How patient do these investors have to be? Are we talking about months or years?
Okay, well, now you're asking for a projection about the coronavirus and the global economy.
I suppose I am, yes.
The combination of the two. And I think I should pass that question over to my economist colleague, Ugo, about how deep the crisis will be in terms of global outflows and inflows and how long the crisis will last. My own lawyerly estimation is that thinking that we will be out of this by the end of 2020 is rather optimistic.
Ugo, what do you think?
So when we thought about this facility, we thought about a facility that would last for about 1 year. But there is massive uncertainty. The IMF recently released its World Economic Outlook forecast. Usually it releases forecasts like 3-4 years ahead. This time it realized 1 year ahead. And even there, they said that, you know, they're really not sure of anything. So we started thinking about a 1 year forecast, but then who knows?
Mita, you're the lawyer here. Can we force creditors legally? Can they be forced to comply with this if they don't want to?
Let's start by saying we don't want to force anybody to comply with it. We want them to voluntarily and happily participate. But you're exactly right. Some will not. And so it is necessary to show them if they do not, the profits will be small from litigating. We try to set this facility up in the first place to be attractive enough for most of them. But then at the back end, we draw on what we would refer to as a significant stick to induce them. And that is an age-old doctrine in international law that goes by the very appropriate name of necessity. This is a doctrine that has been around for at least 100 years. but is very rarely applied. And part of the reason it is very rarely applied is that it applies in circumstances where a country cannot meet its international obligations because its population is at risk and it needs to save its population. And therefore, because a country's primary responsibility is to its population, it is allowed to delay performance on its international obligations. A caveat here is that the country must not be the cause of its problem. So, for example, Argentina in 2001 tried to raise this defense when it went through its massive financial crisis. And a number of the tribunals there said, you know, you're the architect of most of your problems. And so we're not going to give you relief, even though you need relief. International law does not help you. But the coronavirus, I do not think one can argue that any of these poor countries are the architect of the coronavirus. And they do desperately need the money to help their populations. So it is that rarest of rare events where this international law doctrine applies. But all it does is delay. It just delays. And in fact, investors are entitled to compensation for the delay. We think that if investors recognize that they will not fare well in the courts, especially if the G20 itself says, you know, we agree this is a time of great necessity, which is essentially what they've already said in their communiques, then I think investors will refrain from suing, at least for the 12 months or so that we need desperate help for.
Now, looking further down the line, isn't it the case that for all of these countries, we can assume that GDP will go down? Tax revenues will go down, their expenditures will go way up. So even if we have this pause for them, are many of them not going to be forced into a debt restructuring anyway?
In Italian, we have an expression which is a bocce ferme. It comes from the game of bocce. You know, you throw a big ball and you try to get close to a small ball. And this expression says that there is no point to discuss who is winning when the balls are still rolling. So when they stop, you measure. And this is a little bit the same thing. At this point, there is so much uncertainty. And you're completely right. At some point, some countries will be insolvent and they will have to restructure. But at this point, it's very hard to understand who will be able to pay and which country won't. So any debt sustainability analysis, when we don't have an idea about the GDP, is meaningless. The idea of our proposal is sort of like to protect the countries until we have more information. When we have more information, somebody will pay and everybody will be happy and somebody will have to restructure. But in the meantime, we're preventing this leaking of funds, which is going to make the situation only worse.
Meeta, what do you think from your experience?
If we do not have this kind of standstill, it is quite likely that within the next 6 to 12 months, we will have a large number of countries that go into payment default. And the domino effect of that for the global economy would be huge, taking us into a major global recession that is much bigger than the one that we're already going to face. However, the logic is that if we can wait, delay, and then see which countries come out of this positive and which countries were unable to sustain this drop in GNP, then we can just restructure the countries that were unable to sustain it for whatever reasons having to do with that. We're using the delay to lower the overall cost to not only the countries, but the global economy. Because we just don't know, as Ugo said, the uncertainty about a country that needs to restructure its debt today is huge. Yes, they can't pay, but how much can they pay? And we have no idea because we don't know how much the crisis is going to cost them.
Ugo, say you succeed in this and it gets set up and the countries benefit from it. Looking out in the longer term, isn't it going to have a negative effect on credit markets, borrowing in future for these countries?
So this is a question that always comes out whenever there is a proposal for reforming the international architecture, right? When collective action clauses were proposed, you know, this is going to destroy the credit market. This belief that any reform is going to destroy the credit market is based on the belief that countries are trying to do everything not to pay their debt. But actually, the historical experience shows that countries are trying to do everything they can to pay their debt. You know, they usually tend to default very late. And there are actually strong political incentives to pay. That's the more general answer to your question. More specific to this question, one could say, well, you know, if you do this now, then every time there is a crisis, countries are going to come out with some excuse, you know, give us standstill, use necessity. This is really a once in a generation crisis. I mean, what is being done in Europe now, it was unthinkable 3 months ago. The fact that people will say, oh, they did it once, they're going to do it again. I mean, these are truly exceptional circumstances. This would be helped even more if the G20 were actually going to go with a declaration saying, look, this is an exceptional circumstance. So people would not use us as a precedent to cancel the debt for some smaller crisis.
You need some political momentum and some support from the private sector. Mita, do you have any idea that you have that yet? Because you don't have a lot of time to set this up, do you?
I think there isn't enough time to go and canvass everybody. This needs to be set up now, and we need to hope that the logic of it allows for people to participate right away. I don't think there is enough time to take into account every creditor's preferences. In fact, that is the reason it's being set up in the way it is. We can canvass investor preferences after the crisis is ameliorated.
How long do you have?
I think this needed to have been done 3 weeks ago. We don't have time. This needs to be done right away, and we're already late.
Well, I'll let you get back to it. Ugo and Mita, thank you for your time today. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you very much.
If you want to get the detail on this, we've only just scratched the surface of the argument, so download the policy insight from the CEPR. It's Policy Insight 103. It's called Born Out of Necessity, A Debt Standstill for COVID-19. The authors are Patrick Bolton, Lee Buchheit, Pierre-Olivier Gorinchas, Mitu Gulati, Chiang-Chai Xie, Ugo Panizza, and Beatrice Veda Di Mauro. If you don't have access to that at the CEPR website, there's also a column about the proposal at VoxEU, and that's called Necessity is the Mother of Invention. Same authors. Keep in touch with the COVID-19 coverage at VoxEU. We're adding to it every day with articles, videos, webinars, and the COVID Economics Journal, and I'm sure that there'll be more about this in the future. And remember to subscribe to Vox Talk so you never miss an episode. But if you do, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.